It's just about it for the Wrecking Hours. What you just heard was Asmodeus, Warhogs. Before that, another one from Asmodeus, Bloody Choices. Also in this set, the Holy Hackjacks with Chainsaw, Cold Feelings from Social Distortion, and Calamity Man from Batmobile. Up next, as promised, here is from the brand spankin' new release, still due out in stores, Our Way and the Highway, the newest from the Coffin Cats. And that'll do it for the Wrecking Hours. Stay tuned next week for more great, brand new Psychobilly and Rockabilly.
Justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Listen to the 1+1 show on Sunday nights from 9 until midnight. The 1+1 show is hosted by Mrs. Robinson. I'll be bringing you the best in indie rock, indie pop, and music that will just mellow you out. So tune in to the 1+1 show every Sunday from 9 until midnight on the station making waves, WHFR.FM.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Earth Sky. Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, is there anything to be scared of from solar storms? And one of the biggest problems in astrophysics, what makes a star go supernova? Here's a scientist soundbite.
Embarrassing might not even be the right word, but here we're using, discovering the expansion of the universe and giving Nobel Prizes, and we don't really know where these things came from.
That's astronomer Brad Schaefer of Louisiana State University. More with him later, but first, Science News of the Week with Emily Howard and Michael Brennan.
The fifth named storm for the 2012 Indian cyclone season, Cyclone Funso, formed in the Mozambique Channel and became a major hurricane with a sustained wind of 140 miles per hour on January 25, 2012. Funso was responsible for providing heavy rains across Mozambique, which is in southeastern Africa. Combined with ample rainfall from a tropical depression the previous week, rainfall totals were over a foot in many areas. Flooding has been a serious issue across Mozambique, resulting in at least 25 deaths.
A dog skull unearthed in Siberia presents some of the oldest known evidence of dog domestication. The ancient skull was preserved in a cave for 33,000 years. Together with equally ancient dog remains from a cave in Belgium, the Siberian dog skull indicates that the relationship between dogs and humans might have occurred repeatedly and in different geographic locations across the Earth, rather than as a single domestication event.
January 25, 2012 was the 8-year anniversary of the safe landing of the Opportunity rover on planet Mars. The rover touched down at 5:05 a.m. UTC on January 25, 2004, for a planned 3-month mission to explore the red planet. It was 3 weeks after its twin rover, Spirit, arrived on Mars. 8 years later, Opportunity is still going strong. It's essentially on a new mission, exploring the huge Endeavour crater on Mars, which it reached in August of 2011 after a 3-year, 4.8-mile trek from its previous location.
2011 had the greatest economic losses globally due to earthquakes on record. That's according to an analysis by the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction Technology, released earlier this month. Last year, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused a damage of $365 billion U.S. dollars. According to this analysis, 20,500 people died from earthquakes and their effects in 2011. About 1 million people lost their homes. Japan and New Zealand were hit hardest.
A large geomagnetic storm caused by an M8.7 class flare on the sun on January 22nd is over. There were reports of amazing displays of the beautiful aurora, or northern lights, seen at high latitudes on Earth. The Associated Press reported that experienced stargazers were stunned by the intensity of the aurora borealis that swept across the night sky on January 24th. And that's News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Upcoming is our Song of the Week. It's called Better Days, and it's by the band The Boxing Lesson, off their upcoming LP. They're heading out on tour this February, so catch them if you can.
We'll be right back.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Astronomers from Louisiana State University say they've solved a long-standing fundamental problem of what makes a star go supernova, specifically a Type 1a supernova. Astronomers have long considered them standard candles to measure the age of the universe. Their luminosity caps out much like a 60-watt light bulb. The problem is, what creates these supernovae, whether they were created by the collision of two compact stars called white dwarfs, or whether just one white dwarf siphons off mass from a companion star to become that supernova. Dr. Schaefer analyzed images from the Hubble Space Telescope to find out that two white dwarfs, 160,000 light-years away, spiraled into each other to create a supernova. Brad Schaefer spoke with Earth Sky in Austin, Texas, January of 2012, at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society.
A Type 1a supernova is a particular type of supernova. It's a big thermonuclear bomb, kind of like an H-bomb, although on a much bigger scale. And these are particularly important for understanding cosmology, the age and fate of the universe. And the double degenerate part of it there are jargon words for a system where you have two white dwarfs, and those are small, compact core X cores of stars, two white dwarfs going round and round in close orbit around each other, and they ultimately spiral in, and after some relatively long time, they'll spiral in and collide with each other, and when that happens, they explode as one of these Type 1a supernovae. It's long been a very big question as to where these Type 1a supernovae have come from. We've known about these supernovae for 70 years now, but the question is, where do they come from? After large amounts of research, about 30, 40 years ago, people realized that you had to be dealing with part of this system the thing that had to explode would have to be a white dwarf, in particular one made up primarily of carbon and oxygen. And so you have one of these white dwarfs when it gets enough mass, it reaches some upper limit. This upper limit on the mass, when a white dwarf is just that much mass, that will lead to an explosion, fair enough. But the question is, what sort of system can make one of these white dwarfs get to the point where it's at this maximum mass? And there are kind of two general possibilities. One possibility is you have, these two white dwarfs. And if you have the two white dwarfs, when they finally spiral in and hit each other, the combined mass of that white dwarf will be the limit and the thing will explode. Another possibility, it's called a single degenerate model. It's just our jargon. It means, a degenerate star is a white dwarf, and so this single degenerate system is one where you have just one white dwarf, and the other star around it is not a degenerate star, but a normal star, a star like our sun, or perhaps a red giant. And again, they're also in close orbit, and what happens is, if you get the orbits close enough, some of the material from the normal star, the companion star, will fall off and fall down onto the white dwarf, where it will slowly but surely increase the mass of the white dwarf, and at some point the white dwarf will have enough mass that it's going to be at this limit and will start exploding. And so there's long been a tension and an uncertainty back and forth between knowing whether these Type 1a supernovae happen to come from this single degenerate or double degenerate, that is, whether they come from a pair of white dwarfs or whether they come from a white dwarf with a companion star spilling matter over onto it.
Dr. Schaefer, did you find the solution to this Type 1 progenitor problem?
Yes, we did. We have indeed found a very decisive solution to the Type 1a progenitor problem, and we used a little bit of an idea here. I had described how there are these two basic classes of models, the double degenerate and the single degenerate. Well, one way you can go distinguishing them is by looking at what's left behind. If you have two white dwarfs spiraling in, basically both white dwarfs get blown up, and you're left with nothing left behind. Alternatively, if it's a single degenerate, you have a white dwarf and a companion star spilling matter over, when the white dwarf blows up, it'll blow off a little bit of the gas on the companion star, but the companion star will be largely intact and not changed, or not changed by much. So the dodge we're using is to try to find out whether there's an ex-companion star left behind after the eruption. So the trick we use is we look inside a supernova remnant. That's a big gas cloud blown out by the explosion of the white dwarf. And somewhere close in the center, deep in the center of that, should be any ex-companion star. So the idea is you pick a good case supernova remnant, hopefully fairly young, and you look deep in the core of that. If you go finding an ex-companion star, bang, you've just proven that it's a single degenerate. If you find no ex-companion star to deep levels, well, there's no ex-companion star, so you've ruled out single degenerate, so it has to be double degenerate. That's the logic we have. So my advance has been to realize that, wow, you can do this exact same task on supernova remnants that appear in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now, the Large Magellanic Cloud happens to be a fairly small galaxy in orbit around our own Milky Way galaxy, but it's the closest galaxy to our own Milky Way. So there's actually one supernova remnant out of the many in the cloud that's just perfect for our case. Well, it's given a telephone number, SNR0509-67.5. Don't worry about the number. We have to give it a name, so it's a catalog number. There you go. But what you have is this supernova remnant is a very young supernova remnant. It's only 400 years old. So what that means is the ex-companion star, after it flies off when the white dwarf blows up, it won't have had time to move very far, which means it should be really close to the center of this supernova remnant. Also, because the supernova remnant happens to be fairly young, it means it's beautifully symmetric and rather small, which means we can define the center of it to high precision, very good accuracy. Also, that particular supernova remnant happens to be in a very low density, an uncrowded region of the sky. So everything just works perfectly. And so what we've done is we've looked deep in the core, in the very central regions of this, using the Hubble Space Telescope, and what we find is there's no stars there, just none. There's no ex-companion, so the only possible progenitor model is the double degenerate, the one that does not have any ex-companion star left behind. So we actually have a very decisive solution on this. So the statement would be, some version, there are various levels you could call it, but one way of saying it is what we're finding is that for this one particular supernova, that we're finding that there is no possible ex-companion star, and that this decisively and definitively rules out all published models except for one. And that one model that is not excluded is the double degenerate model, where you have two white dwarfs spiraling around in close orbit around each other, spiraling in until they ultimately collide. The mass of the white dwarf gets to the limit, and then it explodes.
You've been listening to astronomer Brad Schaefer. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky, heard on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, and she's here to talk about solar storms. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. In this past week, we've had a couple of big solar storms, and the sun is in a particularly active phase right now. The sun has an 11-year cycle, and right now the sun is in an active part of the cycle, so there are storms going on the sun pretty frequently now. That's in contrast to, say, half a dozen years from now, when there won't be much happening on the sun in terms of solar storms at all. But at the moment, in the year 2012, we have a lot of solar storms going on. And what happens when one of these storms occurs is that charged particles from the sun get released into space. And if a wave of these charged particles strike the Earth, various effects happen, and that causes, instead of it being a solar storm, then it's a geomagnetic storm because the particles interact with the Earth's magnetic field.
Yeah, it creates kind of a storm in our atmosphere.
That's right. So there's this geomagnetic event that takes place, and over the past week, around January 21st and also around January 24th, we had a couple of these big events take place. In fact, the one on the 24th, experts were saying, was the biggest one in the past 7 years. And the thing I want to talk about is that, you know, we put information about these up on our website at earthsky.org, and people in the comments of these posts would say, is the world going to end? Is the world going to end today? because of these solar storms. And I wanted to just get on and say, no.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is the world going to end? Tell us. No, but tell us more about some of this, you know, some of this misunderstanding, some of this fear about solar storms. These storms are perfectly natural, yet they generate a lot of fear when they happen.
Yeah, I mean, storms on the sun have been going on for billions of years since the sun was formed. And all of human history, all of history, the history of life on Earth has evolved, you know, under the auspices of these solar storms that go on, that come and go on the sun. Now the cycle is an 11-year cycle. You know, it's hard to know what that cycle was like billions of years ago. But, you know, there have always been storms on the sun, presumably, and all of human history, for sure, we've had them. And so it's just been kind of surprising that people in here in the year 2012 think that there's, you know, the world is going to end because of a solar storm.
Yeah, I think that there's some, from what I've gathered, it seems to be some confusion about what's happening. The confusion comes from maybe like the storms are doing something that is disabling Earth's natural shield from radiation, you know?
Yeah, and that's not right. Actually, the atmosphere does protect us from this radiation. So if you were an astronaut up in the International Space Station or in some, you know, say in a craft going from the Earth to the Moon, you would have to worry about a solar storm. You would have to worry about this radiation, this blast of radiation coming from the sun, because you wouldn't have Earth's protective blanket of atmosphere wrapped around you. And, you know, the astronauts in orbit and the astronauts, you know, that used to travel to the moon and back had to have special ways of protecting themselves. But, you know, here on Earth's surface, we don't have to worry about that because we have the atmosphere taking care of us.
Yeah, you know, thousands of years ago, people noticed sunspots that are related to these solar storms. You know, no problem back then, but not today. You know, flash forward thousands of years, we have all kinds of technology that is affected by these solar storms.
Yeah, that's right. The Chinese actually observed spots on the sun thousands of years ago. They also didn't have satellites in orbit around the Earth, and they didn't have cell phones, and they didn't have GPS systems, and they didn't have all the technological things that we have today that can actually be affected by solar storms. So the things that can be affected by solar storms are, for example, telecommunications. So if your cell phone is acting up on the day of a solar storm, well, you can blame that on the sun.
Oh, right. And as we become more vulnerable through our technologies become more vulnerable to solar storms. Also, scientists have been launching new observatories to just see what the sun exactly is doing. There's the SOHO, NASA's SOHO Solar and Heliospheric Observatory. There's also the Solar Dynamic Observatory. These are wonderful instruments out there that are watching what the sun is doing.
They are incredible, Jorge, and there is some incredible video and some incredible imagery that's come out of these observatories that are looking at the sun. And when these solar storms occur, they're beautiful. And there have been some beautiful videos that have resulted from those storms. So we get to see those very beautiful things that also have come from our technology. And in addition, there's one natural phenomenon that occurs as a result of a solar storm that people at very high latitudes can see.
What's that?
Well, I'm talking about the aurora borealis, which is the northern lights. And of course, there's an aurora australis as well, a southern lights on the southernmost part of Earth, mostly seen by people in Antarctica. It's pretty rare that it's seen outside of Antarctica. But the northern lights, because there's more land up at the northern part of Earth, is actually seen at high latitudes, say, the Scandinavian countries or in Canada, northern Russia, places like that. We'll see the northern lights. And when there's a very powerful solar storm, the northern lights can be seen even further south. And there have even been times when they've been seen as far south as here in Texas.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Okote Soul Sounds, Sleep Good, The Boxing Lesson, The Black and White Years, and 100 Flowers For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.
Earth, sky.
The hunt for dark matter has a lot in common with the hunt for planets back in the 1800s. So there's a lot of potential to understand dark matter from its effects on other things, from its gravitational effects.
You're listening to astrophysicist Sukanya Chakrabarty of Florida Atlantic University, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Chakrabarty is talking about a mystery of science, what scientists call dark matter. Scientists say that a halo of dark matter surrounds spiral galaxies like our Milky Way. Dr. Chakrabarty developed a new way to map dark matter, looking at the ripples made by dark matter in the outer gas disks of spiral galaxies. She explained her findings to Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Austin, Texas.
Dr. Chakrabarty, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Thank you.
So tell us about the results of your study that looked at mapping dark matter in nearby spiral galaxies. What did you find out?
What I found in this study is that the ripples in the outer gas disks of galaxies act as a mirror of the depth of the dark matter potential well. So if the potential well is very steep, the kind of disturbances that form in the outer gas disk are very tightly wrapped. If the potential well is very shallow, the disturbances that form are more loosely wrapped. So by looking at the kind of structures that form in the outer gas disks of galaxies, we can get a handle on the underlying dark matter density distribution. So basically, the observational result that I'm analyzing are the atomic hydrogen maps. So these are maps of the cold gas on the outskirts of galaxies. When you're looking at the very outskirts, it's much more likely that the disturbances that you see there are due to some sort of external perturber, like a galactic satellite that's come by and perturbed the surrounding gas distribution, rather than looking at the inner regions, which are much more messy and much more difficult to model computationally.
Okay, so I guess at the outer disk of this nearby galaxy that you looked at, that's where it is interacting with other galaxies, is that right?
Right, right. So I analyzed specifically the Whirlpool Galaxy. It's also known as M51. It has a very dramatic arm that extends out to very large distances. And that arm is the product of a merger of a tidal interaction with its own satellite. So in an earlier paper, we showed that by looking at the strength of the disturbances, this is work that I presented at last year's AAS press conference. I showed with a number of collaborators that by looking at the strength of the disturbances, we could figure out how massive the dwarf galaxy is that produced the structures that we see in the outer gas disk, and also where it is in radius and azimuth. So in principle, this gives you a means of hunting for dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies. And this is one of the problems we now face in modern cosmology. There's something called the missing satellites problem, where theorists expected to see many more galactic satellites than are actually observed in the local neighborhood. So we wanted to come up with a method that allows you to find galactic satellites, dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies, from analysis of their gravitational effects on other bodies without requiring knowledge of their stellar light, because many of these things are very dim. They're very dark matter-dominated, so they don't have a lot of optical light. So we wanted to figure out a way of you know, hunting for them without needing to see their stellar light. So this is actually quite similar to the way Neptune was discovered in the 1840s. So in the 1840s, Le Verrier analyzed disturbances in the orbits of Uranus, and he made the hypothesis that they were due to a yet unseen planet.
And he was able to figure out the azimuth of that planet, now known as Neptune, to within a degree. So that's the first example of the discovery of an essentially dark object from analysis of its effects, its gravitational effects on another body. And it's in a similar spirit to the work that we're trying to do.
Just to back up a second, please describe for us, what is dark matter?
Right. So one of the most of the mass in galaxies is dark. And this was observationally inferred on galactic scales back in the 70s. So in the 70s, what we found were that when you looked at the rotation curves of galaxies, when you looked at the circular speed in galaxies, it continued to be flat out to large distances. And these distances were large compared to the region where you saw the stars. Okay, and from Newtonian gravity, you expect the circular speed to fall. We had expected the circular speed to fall off at large distances where we didn't see the stars. But it continued to be flat out to very large distances that are, you know, distances that are large compared to the region where we saw emission from the stars. So it was then inferred that there is an unseen dark component that is producing these flat rotation curves. So dark matter is dark because it doesn't emit any electromagnetic radiation. But it is massive, so that means that it will interact gravitationally with whatever else, right? So that's the main thing that we're taking advantage of here. It's the fact that we can study its gravitational signatures on a very highly responsive thing, and that's the cold gas. The cold gas is a great tracer because it's very responsive. So it's basically like, you know, dropping pebbles into a pond and looking at the ripples in the pond and trying to figure out how massive was the pebble. You know, if you sort of understood the physics of that well enough, you might be able to do it, even if you didn't see the pebble falling.
Tell us about this step towards actually being able to put it on a map and see what it looks like.
So that's exactly what we're trying to, you know, do here, to map it. And by mapping it, you know, that means to figure out, you know, not just it has some total mass, but to figure out, you know, how much of it is in the central regions, how much of it in the outer regions, and so forth, to actually create a map of it, you know, like you were trying to create a map of the world or something like that.
What's the most important thing you'd like people today to know about investigating dark matter?
The hunt for dark matter has a lot in common with the hunt for planets back in the 1800s. So there's a lot of potential to understand dark matter from its effects on other things, from its gravitational effects on other things. I think that's a very promising thing. It's very similar in spirit to the way Neptune was discovered. It's a kind of indirect means of hunting for this thing that we can't see.
You've been listening to astrophysicist Sukanya Chakrabarty of Florida Atlantic University. For this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
When I was 7 years old and my sister was just 5 years old, we were playing on top of a bunk bed. I was 2 years older than my sister at the time. I mean, I'm 2 years older than her now, but at the time that meant she had to do everything that I wanted to do, and I wanted to play war. So we were up on top of our bunk beds, and on one side of the bunk bed, I had put out all my G.I. Joe soldiers and weaponry, and on the other side were all my sister's Milos and ponies and ready for a cavalry charge. There are differing accounts of what actually happened that afternoon, but since my sister is not here with us today, let me tell you the true story. Which is, my sister is a little bit on the clumsy side, and somehow, without any help or push from her older brother at all, suddenly Amy disappeared off of the top of the bunk bed and landed with this crash on the floor. And I nervously peered over the side of the bed to see what had befallen my fallen sister, and saw that she had landed painfully on her hands and knees on all fours on the ground. I was nervous because my parents had charged me with making sure that my sister and I played as safely and as quietly as possible. And seeing as how I had accidentally broken Amy's arm just 1 week before, heroically pushing her out of the way of an oncoming imaginary sniper bullet. for which I have yet to be thanked. I was trying as hard as I could. She didn't even see it coming. I was trying as hard as I could to be on my best behavior, and I saw in my sister's face this wail of pain and suffering and surprise, threatening to erupt from her mouth and threatening to wake my parents from the long winter's nap for which they had settled. So I did the only thing my little frantic 7-year-old brain could think to do to avert this tragedy. If you have children, you've seen this hundreds of times before. I said, Amy, wait, don't cry, don't cry. Did you see how you landed? No human lands on all fours like that. Amy, I think this means you're a unicorn. Now, that was cheating because there's nothing in the world my sister would want more than not to be Amy the hurt 5-year-old little sister, but Amy the special unicorn. Of course, this was an option that was open to her brain at no point in the past, and you could see on my poor, manipulated sister's face conflict. As her little brain attempted to devote resources to feeling the pain and suffering surprise she just experienced, or contemplating her newfound identity as a unicorn. And the latter won out. Instead of crying, instead of ceasing our play, instead of waking my parents with all the negative consequences that would have ensued for me, instead, a smile spread across her face, and she scrambled right back up onto the bunk bed with all the grace of a baby unicorn with one broken leg. Well, we stumbled across. At this tender age of just 5 and 7, we had no idea at the time was something that was going to be at the vanguard of a scientific revolution occurring 2 decades later in the way that we look at the human brain. What we had stumbled across is something called positive psychology, which is the reason that I'm here today and the reason that I wake up every morning. When I first started to talk about this research outside of academia, out with companies and schools, the very first thing they said to never do is to start your talk with a graph. The very first thing I wanted to do is start my talk with a graph. This graph looks boring, but this graph is the reason that I get excited and wake up every morning. And this graph doesn't even mean anything. It's fake data. What we found is if I got this data back studying you here in the room, I would be thrilled because there's very clearly a trend that's going on there, and that means that I can get published, which is all that really matters. The fact that there's one weird red dot that's up above the curve, there's one weird in the room, you know who you are. I saw you earlier. That's no problem. That's no problem, as most of you know, because I can just delete that dot. I can delete that dot because that's clearly a measurement error, and we know that's a measurement error because it's messing up my data. So one of the very first things that we teach people in economics and statistics and business and psychology courses is how, in a statistically valid way, do we eliminate the weirdos? How do we eliminate the outliers? So that we can find the line of best fit, which is fantastic if I'm trying to find out how many Advil the average person should be taking, too. But if I'm interested in potential, if I'm interested in your potential or for happiness or productivity or energy or creativity, what we're doing is we're creating the cult of the average with science. If I ask a question like, how fast can a child learn how to read in a classroom? Scientists change the answer to, how fast does the average child learn how to read in that classroom? And then we tailor the class right towards the average. Now, if you fall below the average on this curve, then psychologists get thrilled, because that means you're either depressed or you have a disorder or hopefully both. We're hoping for both because our business model is if you come into a therapy session with one problem, we want to make sure you leave knowing you have 10. So you'll keep coming back over and over again. We'll go back into your childhood if necessary, but eventually what we want to do is to make you normal again. But normal is merely average. And what I posit and what positive psychology posits is that if we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average. Then instead of deleting those positive outliers, what I intentionally do is come into a population like this one and says, why? Why is it that some of you are so high above the curve in terms of your intellectual ability, athletic ability, musical ability, creativity, energy levels, your resiliency in the face of challenge, your sense of humor? Whatever it is, instead of deleting you, what I want to do is study you. Because maybe we can glean information, not just how to move people up to the average, but how we can move the entire average up at our companies and schools worldwide. The reason this graph is important to me is when I turn on the news, it seems like the majority of the information is not positive. In fact, it's negative. Most of it's about murder, corruption, diseases, natural disasters, and very quickly, my brain starts to think that's the accurate ratio of negative to positive in the world. What that's doing is creating something called the medical school syndrome, which if you know people who have been to medical school during the first year of medical training, as you read through a list of all the symptoms and diseases that could happen, suddenly you realize you have all of them. I have a brother-in-law named Bobo, which is a whole other story. Bobo married Amy the unicorn. Bobo called me on the phone from Yale Medical School. From Yale Medical School, and Bobo said, Sean, I have leprosy. Which even at Yale is extraordinarily rare. But I had no idea how to console poor Bobo because he had just gotten over an entire week of menopause. See, what we're finding is it's not necessarily the reality that shapes us, but the lens through which your brain views the world that shapes your reality. And if we can change the lens, not only can we change your happiness, we can change every single educational and business outcome at the same time. When I applied to Harvard, I applied on a dare. I didn't expect to get in, and my family had no money for college. When I got a military scholarship 2 weeks later that allowed me to go, suddenly something that wasn't even a possibility became a reality. When I went there, I assumed everyone else would see it as a privilege as well, that they'd be excited to be there. Even if you're in a classroom full of people smarter than you, you'd be happy just to be in that classroom, which is what I felt. But what I found there is while some people experienced that, when I graduated after my 4 years and then spent the next 8 years living in the dorms with the students, Harvard asked me to. I wasn't that guy. But what happened? I was an officer of Harvard to counsel students through the difficult 4 years, and what I found in my research and my teaching is that these students, no matter how happy they were with the original success of getting into the school, 2 weeks later, their brains were focused not on the privilege of being there, nor on their philosophy or their physics. Their brain was focused on the competition, the workload, the hassles, the stresses, the complaints. When I first went in there, I walked into the freshman dining hall, which is where my friends from Waco, Texas, which is where I grew up, I know some of you have heard of it. When they come to visit me, they look around, they say, this freshman dining hall looks like something out of Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter, which it does. This is Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter, and that's Harvard. And when they see this, they say, Sean, why do you waste your time studying happiness at Harvard? Seriously, what does a Harvard student possibly have to be unhappy about? Embedded within that question is the key to understanding the science of happiness. Because what that question assumes is that our external world is predictive of our happiness levels. When in reality, if I know everything about your external world, I can only predict 10% of your long-term happiness. 90% of your long-term happiness is predicted not by the external world, but by the way your brain processes the world. And if we change it, if we change our formula for happiness and success, what we can do is change the way that we can then affect reality. What we found is that only 25% of job successes are predicted by IQ. 75% of job successes are predicted by your optimism levels, your social support, and your ability to see stress as a challenge instead of as a threat. I talked to a boarding school up in New England, probably the most prestigious boarding school, and they said, we already know that. So every year, instead of just teaching our students, we also have a wellness week, and we're so excited. Monday night, we have the world's leading expert coming in to speak about adolescent depression. Tuesday night is school violence and bullying. Wednesday night is eating disorders. Thursday night is illicit drug use. And Friday night, we're trying to decide between risky sex or happiness. I said, that's most people's Friday nights. Which I'm glad you liked, but they did not like that at all. Silence on the phone. And into the silence, I said, I'd be happy to speak at your school, but just so you know, that's not a wellness week. That's a sickness week. What you've done is you've outlined all the negative things that can happen, but not talked about the positive. The absence of disease is not health. Here's how we get to health. We need to reverse the formula for happiness and success. In the past 3 years, I've traveled to 45 different countries, working with schools and companies in the midst of an economic downturn. And what I found is that most companies and schools follow a formula for success, which is this. If I work harder, I'll be more successful. And if I'm more successful, then I'll be happier. That undergirds most of our parenting styles, our managing styles, the way that we motivate our behavior, and the problem is it's scientifically broken and backwards for two reasons. First, every time your brain has a success, you just change the goalpost of what success looked like. You got good grades, now you have to get better grades. You got into a good school, now you have to get a better school. You got a good job, now you have to get a better job. You hit your sales target, we're gonna change your sales target. And if happiness is on the opposite side of success, your brain never gets there. What we've done is we've pushed happiness over the cognitive horizon as a society. And that's because we think we have to be successful, then we'll be happier. But the real problem is our brains work in the opposite order. If you can raise somebody's level of positivity in the present, then their brain experiences what we now call a happiness advantage, which is your brain at positive performs significantly better than it does at negative, neutral, stressed. Your intelligence rises, your creativity rises, your energy levels rise. In fact, what we found is that every single business outcome improves. Your brain at positive is 31% more productive than your brain at negative, neutral, or stressed. You're 37% better at sales. Doctors are 19% faster, more accurate at coming up with the correct diagnosis when positive instead of negative, neutral, or stressed, which means we can reverse the formula. If we can find a way of becoming positive in the present, then our brains work even more successfully as we're able to work harder, faster, and more intelligently. What we need to be able to do is to reverse this formula so we can start to see what our brains are actually capable of. Because dopamine, which floods into your system when you're positive, has two functions. Not only does it make you happier, it turns on all the learning centers in your brain, allowing you to adapt to the world in a different way. We found that there are ways that you can train your brain to be able to become more positive. In just a 2-minute span of time, done for 21 days in a row, we can actually rewire your brain, allowing your brain to actually work more optimistically and more successfully. We've done these things in research now in every single company that I've worked with, getting them to write down 3 new things that they're grateful for 21 days in a row, 3 new things each day, And at the end of that, their brain starts to retain a pattern of scanning the world not for the negative, but for the positive first. Journaling about one positive experience you've had over the past 24 hours allows your brain to relive it. Exercise teaches your brain that your behavior matters. We find that meditation allows your brain to get over the cultural ADHD that we've been creating by trying to do multiple tasks at once, and allows our brains to focus on the task at hand. And finally, random acts of kindness or conscious acts of kindness. We get people when they open up their inbox to write one positive email praising or thanking somebody in their social support network. And by doing these activities and by training your brain just like we train our bodies, what we found is we can reverse the formula for happiness and success, and in doing so, not only create ripples of positivity, but create a real revolution. Thank you very much.
As the highest military commander of the Netherlands, with troops stationed around the world, I'm really honored to be here today. When I look around this TEDx Amsterdam venue, I see a very special audience. You are the reason why I said yes to the invitation to come here today. When I look around, I see people who want to make a contribution. I see people who want to make a better world. By doing groundbreaking scientific work, by creating impressive works of art, by writing critical articles or inspiring books, by starting up sustainable businesses, and you all have chosen your own instruments to fulfill this mission of creating a better world. Some chose the microscope as their instrument. Others chose dancing or painting or making music like we just heard. Some chose the pen. Others work through the instrument of money. Ladies and gentlemen, I made a different choice. Ladies and gentlemen, I share your goals. I share the goals of the speakers you heard before. I did not choose to take up the pen, the brush, the camera. I chose this instrument. I chose the gun. For you, and you heard already, being so close to this gun may make you feel uneasy. It may even feel scary. A real gun at a few feet's distance. Let us stop for a moment and feel this uneasiness. You could even hear it. Let us cherish the fact that probably most of you have never been close to a gun. It means the Netherlands is a peaceful country. The Netherlands is not at war. It means soldiers are not needed to patrol our streets. Guns are not a part of our lives. In many countries, it is a different story. In many countries, people are confronted with guns. They are oppressed. They are intimidated by warlords, by terrorists, by criminals. Weapons can do a lot of harm. They are the cause of much distress. Why then am I standing before you with this weapon? Why did I choose the gun as my instrument? Today, I want to tell you why. Today, I want to tell you why I chose the gun to create a better world. And I want to tell you how this gun can help. My story starts in the city of Nijmegen, in the east of the Netherlands, the city where I was born. My father was a hard-working baker. But when he had finished working the bakery, he often told me and my brother stories. And most of the time, he told me this story I'm going to share with you now. The story of what happened when he was a conscript soldier in the Dutch armed forces at the beginning of the Second World War. The Nazis invaded the Netherlands. Their grim plans were evident. They meant to rule by means of repression. Diplomacy had failed to stop the Germans. Only brute force remained. It was our last resort. My father was there to provide it. As the son of a farmer who knew how to hunt, my father was an excellent marksman. When he aimed, he never missed. At this decisive moment in Dutch history, my father was positioned on the bank of the River Waal near the city of Nijmegen. He had a clear shot at the German soldiers who came to occupy a free country, his country, our country. He fired. Nothing happened. He fired again. No German soldier fell to the ground. My father had been given an old gun that could not even reach the opposite riverbank. Hitler's troops marched on, and there was nothing my father could do about it. Until the day my father died, he was frustrated about missing these shots. He could have done something. With an old gun, not even the best marksman in the armed forces could have hit the mark. So this story stayed with me. Then in high school, I was gripped by the stories of the Allied soldiers. Soldiers who left the safety of their own homes and risked their lives to liberate a country and a people that they didn't know. They liberated my birth town. It was then that I decided I would take up the gun. Out of respect and gratitude for those men and women who came to liberate us. From the awareness that sometimes only the gun can stand between good and evil. And that is why I took up the gun. Not to shoot, not to kill, not to destroy, but to stop those who would do evil, to protect the vulnerable, to defend democratic values, to stand up for the freedom we have to talk here today in Amsterdam about how we can make the world a better place. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not stand here today to tell you about the glory of weapons. I do not like guns. And once you have been under fire yourself, it brings home even more clearly that a gun is not some macho instrument to brag about. I stand here today to tell you about the use of the gun as an instrument of peace and stability. The gun may be one of the most important instruments of peace and stability that we have in this world. Now, this may sound contradictory to you, but not only have I seen with my own eyes during my deployments in the Lebanon, Sarajevo, and as the Netherlands Chief of Defense, this is also supported by cold, hard statistics. violence has declined dramatically over the last 500 years. Despite the pictures we are shown daily in the news, wars between developed countries are no longer commonplace. The murder rate in Europe has dropped by a factor of 30 since the Middle Ages. And occurrences of civil war and repression have declined since the end of the Cold War. Statistics show that we are living in a relatively peaceful era. Why? Why has violence decreased? Has the human mind changed? Well, we were talking on the human mind this morning. Did we simply lose our beastly impulses for revenge, for violent rituals, for pure rage? Or is there something else? In his latest book, Harvard professor Steven Pinker, and many other thinkers before him, concludes that one of the main society, the main drivers behind less violent societies is the spread of the constitutional state. And the introduction on a large scale of the state monopoly on the legitimized use of violence, legitimized by a democratically elected government, legitimized by checks and balances and an independent judicial system. In other words, a state monopoly that has the use of violence well under control. Such a state monopoly on violence, first of all, serves as a reassurance. It removes the incentive for an arms race between potentially hostile groups in our societies. Secondly, the presence of penalties that outweigh the benefits of using violence tips the balance even further. Abstaining from violence becomes more profitable than starting a war. Now, non-violence starts to work like a flywheel. It enhances peace even further. Where there is no conflict, trade flourishes. And trade is another important incentive. Humans will find a way of living together without violence and oppression. But until that day comes, we will have to make ideals and human failure meet somewhere in the middle. Until that day comes, I stand for my father, who tried to shoot the Nazis with that old gun. I stand for my men and women who are prepared to risk their lives for a less violent world for all of us. I stand for this soldier who suffered partial hearing loss and sustained permanent injuries to her leg when she was hit by a rocket on her mission in Afghanistan. Ladies and gentlemen, until the day comes when we can do away with the gun, I hope we all agree that peace and stability do not come free of charge. It takes hard work, often behind the scenes. It takes good equipment and well-trained, dedicated soldiers. I hope you will support the efforts of our armed forces to train soldiers like this young captain and provide her with a good gun instead of the bad gun my father was given. I hope you will support our soldiers when they are out there, when they come home, and when they are injured and need our care. They put their lives on the line for us, for you. And we cannot let them down. I hope you will respect my soldiers, this soldier with this gun, because she wants a better world, because she makes an active contribution to that better world, just like all of us here today. Thank you very much.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
This is an official station of the MAEB. The Michigan Association of Educational Broadcasters was formed in 1977 to support your local high school and college radio stations. These stations serve the community and create alternative programming. But most importantly, they discover and train the next generation of broadcasters. For more information on the MAEB and its affiliates, visit www.maeb.org.
HFCC will offer a five-day seminar titled Power Up Your Communication for the Unemployed, Underemployed, and Veterans from February 6th through 10th, 2012. The seminar will take place each day from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the HFCC MTech located at 3601 Schaefer Road in Dearborn. The seminar objective is to teach participants how to communicate effectively, strengthen interpersonal relationships, tap unrecognized potential, and handle fast-changing workplace conditions. Admission is free thanks to a grant from the U.S. Department of Labor. Seating is limited and will be on a first-come, first-served basis. Participants must provide proof of their employment status and veteran status. Please visit hfcc.edu/mtech for the enrollment form or call 313-317-6607 with additional questions. HFCC, the right education, right